Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we revisit our candid conversation with the great director Penelope Spheeris in honor of the 30th anniversary of her movie, Wayne's World. We're not worthy, Greg. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also chat about some of her other projects, like the Decline of Western Civilization documentary films. But first, we review some new music from Bartiz Strange and Yaya Bey.
That is a little bit of Mulholland Drive from the second full album by Bartiz Strange, born Bartiz Leon Cox. Greg, you first introduced us to him as a buried treasure in November 2020. Fascinating upbringing this young man had. Born in Ipswich, England, to a military engineer father and an opera singer mom, moved at age 9 or 10 to a small town in Oklahoma, Mustang. Spent some time working for nonprofit groups as a PR spokesman, and then blows up big in the music world with his debut album, Live Forever. That gets him signed to one of the hippest indie labels in the world, the long-running powerhouse 4AD. What is he giving us on this, his first really highly anticipated album? We'll play a track, and then we'll dive into our opinions. The record is called Farm to Table. This song is called Heavy Heart by Bartiz Strange.
Heavy Heart from Farm to Table, the Bartiz Strange record that has been, as you said, Jim, one of the most anticipated records of the year, I think, based on the reception that debut record got. And, you know, not just fans were responding, but his peers in the music world were singing his praises. You know, he was getting a lot of year-end love from these artists. Lucy Dacus took him out on tour last year. Yep. That was a lot of great exposure for him. And a lot of this record is a reflection on that. The idea that he went from a nobody in 2020 to suddenly everybody's talking about this guy.
I meant to mention that it starts with the title, right? In some ways, rural Oklahoma to the big cities. But also, he felt like an outsider, and now he has a seat at the table.
Exactly. In fact, that song we just played, Heavy Heart, talks about some of the feelings that he has about thriving. On one level, this is a very introspective record. He's grateful, he's humbled, he's empathetic. You know, he was dealing with this whirlwind that greeted his first album, and that even as people were being crushed by the pandemic, he was enjoying a tremendous amount of success. His career took off. And in some ways, he's feeling that. He's like, okay, why was I able to have these last 2 years that were so beneficial to me personally when I see so many of my peers, family members suffering? So on one level, the record is about that. But then he has an incredible sense as a songwriter for these big choruses, these big refrains. I mean, this guy is like ready for the arenas right now.
You know,
these big songs, and a lot of guitars on the songs as well. He's a fairly accomplished guitar player, and he's layering them on big and heavy. Those songs, Heavy Heart, Mulholland Drive, Wretched, big surfaces, big refrains. I am wondering, is this really what we're going to expect from this guy from now on? You know, he feels like he has to play to those big seats. Mm-hmm. I like the stuff on this record where it's a little weirder. It just feels a little bit different. A track like Tours, the falsetto, the acoustic textures.
Looking back, I know that she tried so hard.
Hennessy with those piano chords and that loose gospel feel at the end. The way Escape This Circus, this critique of capitalism that sort of sneaks into the record.
Yep.
A
clunky system by some crypto, he
had holes in his shoes. And he ends up having this big outburst of melody at the end, a very unconventional structure for the song. That song held the line where he's addressing George Floyd's daughter. You know, those are the kind of songs that I associate with Bartiz Strange as a really inventive songwriter. So I feel in some ways he's compromised what he can do, as if he were playing to an audience that he anticipates is wants to hear this kind of thing. And what I think made Bartiz Strange so intriguing in the first place was the fact that he wasn't playing by the conventional rules.
Yeah, I wish I liked this record, but I don't. And the more I listened to it, the more it began to grate.
Well, what's your problem? What's your biggest problem with it?
Well, you know, I'm allergic to power ballads.
Right.
Hair metal.
They're here.
You know, way over the top. And then he goes further past over the top. I like the quieter, more minimalist moments.
Yeah.
I wish he had more to say. You mentioned that Hold the Line is a prayer for the daughter of George Floyd. But Bartiz Strange doesn't have much to say. He sings, "Can't imagine what's running through her young mind now." I was like, well, could you have tried? It would have been interesting.
See that child. Can't imagine what's running through a young man now.
I'm allergic to the more theatrical end of emo. I've been trying to overcome my emo allergy for some time. But wow, I wish I heard the acoustic demos for this record instead of this production. Man, I don't hear the honesty there. Oh, it's like, really? This is all you got to say on this much anticipated big sophomore album? It's getting great reviews, though, from everybody else. What do I know?
Well, I haven't read any of the other reviews, but I do agree with you that I think, based on what I was hearing on the first record, this is a bit of a letdown.
First things first, I'm the one and the two and the three. I saw the others, they'll never be me. Show me one thing that's been worth risking me, babe. Why you no like nice things?
That's a little bit of a song called Keisha from the new Yaya Bay record, Remember Your North Star. Not many people may know who Yaya Bay is. Well, you're going to find out about her in a minute here. She's been making records since 2016, has had an interesting life. I mean, she's in her 30s. She's done quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Brooklyn-based songwriter. She's a poet, a multidisciplinary artist. A singer, a rapper. She's been releasing music, as I said, since 2016. She started writing songs, though, when she was a kid. Her dad was a hip-hop artist in Brooklyn, and she was helping him write hooks.
Yeah.
And he goes, "You're not much of a singer, but you can write some good songs." You know?
She tells that story in every interview, and you think, you know, Dad, I hope that you're kicking yourself now.
That's right. Well, she's obviously a better singer than Dad
indicated. I'll say, yes.
And sort of on a very independent level, she's definitely charted her own course. She is not playing by the traditional industry rules. She's an artist. She wants to make artistic music for her and her friends and people that she can relate to. She's not interested in a wider pop market. This record could be seen as her big coming out record. I mean, she got quite a bit of acclaim for the 2020 album called Madison Tapes. Now she has a follow-up to that record, Remember Your North Star. We're going to review it in a second. Here's a track from it called Pour Up from Yaya Bay on Sound Opinions.
Up
baby, let me show you I had a good time. Yeah, baby, you gon' beg to hit the rewind. Oh, baby, pay attention to the baseline. Yeah, baby, there's a party at my waistline. Baby, pull up the love. Baby, pull up the love. Baby, roll up the bud. Baby, roll up the bud. Don't you wanna reset? You don't wanna regret giving up on love.
That is Pour Up by Yaya Bey from the new album Remember Your North Star. I think she's poised to reach the largest audience of her career yet with this record, and she well deserves it. Could not overcome my hair metal allergy with Bartiz Strange. I was able to overcome my skits allergy with Yaya Bey. There are five skits, you know, most of them half a minute long. You know, I hate skits. An amazing voice. Dad, I don't know what he was thinking when he told her she couldn't sing. The range of her voice from almost intimate bedroom whisper to something full-throated and really powerful and soulful. This is an album, she has pointed out, that is about centering Black womanhood, working through misogynoir. She's talking about relationships, the desire for love, the failed relationships. Mm-hmm. She's done some living at 32. And so there's a lot of perspective here, and she has a lot to say. You're born alone and you'll die the same. A heavy thing, too broken to be a daughter, too wild to be a lover. Talking about herself, some of the language is not safe for work, but it is never gratuitous. I love the earthy production. I love her vocals. I love her message. This is just an inspiring, uplifting, and wonderful record.
Yeah, it's unconventional. 18 songs, half under 2 minutes. I mean, you mentioned the interludes, but I'm gonna say something about those skits in a second here that I think
you're always defending the skits, man.
I think they're important to this record, and I'll tell you why in a second. But musically, it's all over the map, which I love. You know, that songwriting, you know, roots that she's had. You know, she's well versed, an agile singer. An agile songwriter, conversant in a lot of different styles. You get a little bit of jazz with All Right.
If I just give it to the sky, I bet it might just be all right, all right, all right.
In hip-hop, Big Daddy, yeah. That reggae song, Meet Me in Brooklyn.
Which is just celebratory, yeah. And that's only like 2 minutes long or
and
less.
Right, and most of the record is short and sweet. You know, yeah. It's like this jigsaw puzzle that's coming together. Subtle arrangements, you know, at times lo-fi, but I like the variety of musical styles she's attempting here. I appreciate the lack of polish. You know, I think she's in a league with artists like FKA Twigs, SZA, Deb Hines. You know, she's kind of on the avant-garde end of the R&B spectrum.
And yet at times she's so accomplished that it can be like Sade.
Right. And that track, All Right, in particular, you know? Black women are underappreciated, you know, a theme that you have touched on here already.
Many times.
And underloved. She talks about her mother in the interlude that I'm going to reference here, the skit. Mm-hmm. I'm certain she's there.
Too broken to be a daughter, too wild to be a lover, a ghost, an imaginary thing.
She's talking about her mother as if she's a ghost.
Yeah,
you know, someone who was never seen, never really heard, isn't appreciated for who she is. And she extends that to all Black womanhood. You know, me, my mom, our community as Black women in the world. It's a very moving statement. And you piece these songs together and you get a full picture of what it feels like to be a Black woman in 2022.
Well, like I said, I overcame my allergy. It doesn't entirely derail what I think is a brilliant album, another of the year's best. We just did our mid-year best of, but this is an instant contender.
Jim and I just reviewed two interesting, fascinating records that are getting a lot of buzz. We want to know what you think about the new ones from Bartiz Strange and Yaya Bey. Leave us a voice message with your opinion on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up, our conversation with director Penelope Spheeris. I can't wait. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Codd here with Jim DeRogatis, and that's a little snippet of the theme song used for the 1992 film Wayne's World, directed by our guest today, Penelope Spheeris. Now, Penelope, she began her directing career filming shorts with the great Albert Brooks on Saturday Night Live.
Many people don't even know that.
Yeah, it's an amazing little anecdote about her career. And after getting sort of burned out on that Hollywood scene, she started making independent documentaries, a game changer, The Decline of Western Civilization, beginning in 1981.
You know, The Decline, Part 1, Greg, is one of the all-time great punk rock films. Entertaining for different reasons was Part 2, which looked at the developing hair metal scene. I didn't like it for the music, but Penelope caught a different version of the rock dream very convincingly in that film. And then there's even a third, Decline of Western Civilization, where she looks at gutter punk. I think that's more of a work of sociology and great kind of street journalism than it is music. But clearly, to the core of her being, this woman is a rock fan. She got a call back when from Lorne Michaels of SNL to direct the film version of what had been a successful skit, Wayne's World. Two guys, Mike Myers, Dana Carvey, sitting in the basement pretending to be zonked out heavy metal fans, right? How do you make this into a movie? People were kind of wary about that. But the 1992 film, I'm sorry, it's one of the all-time classics in pop culture, certainly in rock and roll. Penelope, we are honored to have you on, the director of Wayne's World and so much else. Welcome to Sound Opinions.
Well, thank you very much.
When you were making Wayne's World, all right, mm-hmm. It's early on in your career. It's Mike Myers' first movie. You know, did you ever think that decades later people would hold it in such esteem and want to be talking to you about it, you know, as if it was Citizen Kane?
No, it never occurred to me or any of us that it would actually hold up this long. It's been amazing. People still love it. It's crazy.
What do you think it is? That I mean, you know, Greg and I have hosted this show with two guys talking about music they love. Obviously, we have a fondness of thinking about, two doofuses in on the couch talking about music they love. You know, how do you make a movie
out of
that?
Sketch. It was a Saturday Night Live sketch, right? And you turned it into a whole movie. I mean, did you think it had that kind of potential?
That was the big fear that the studio Paramount had, was how are you going to make a movie out of that little sketch? And, you know, Bonnie and Terry Turner, the writers, and Mike and Dana as well. I mean, we all pitched in to try to, you know, make it as funny and rich and cool of a movie as possible. But we never thought it would make the money that it did. We never thought 25 years later people would still be talking about it. We just wanted to get through to the end of the shoot, you know?
I mean, not a huge budget, $14 million. It ends up making $180 million and counting. Since then, and it continues to be shown to a capacity audience. I hope you're getting some of the residuals on that, Penelope, by the way. I hope you're still getting paid for that movie.
Well, here's the thing. When Paramount was going to do the movie, it didn't even remotely occur to them that it may have this kind of box office or staying power. So they were generous enough to give me a large percentage of it, and I'm actually really, really rich.
That's refreshing, because we talked to the Spinal Tap fellows.
Oh, yeah. They got screwed.
Didn't make a dime off of that movie.
Is that right?
The second greatest movie of rock history.
Yeah, I almost directed that one, too. But here's the thing. I feel very fortunate that, we lucked out with the movie and that my agent was smart enough to say, hey, give her a percentage, and that Paramount's still sending the checks. It's like, I was raised in a trailer park, you know. It was like, I didn't have any money, and I didn't make any money until I was like 45 years old when I did Wayne's World.
Well,
you know, I get all these people saying, oh, what am I going to do, man? I'm in the movie business and I can't make any money. And I'm like, you're 20 years old. Come back when you're 45, dude.
Patience and perseverance.
That's right.
Let's go back to the beginning, Penelope. You grew up in New Orleans?
Actually, I was born in New Orleans, and my father owned a carnival, and my mom was the ticket taker, and we traveled all through the South. So all of us four kids were born in different states, like, that. You know, whenever she was going to pop one, they'd stop, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then get right back on the road.
And get back right on the road. There you go.
What are your earliest memories of falling in love with music? Because with the Decline films, with the use of the soundtrack, and everything you've done has this musical consciousness. Do you remember when you fell in love with music?
I think probably around the same time most people do. You know, it's that those teenage year, early, like tweener kind of years, you know, where you're just trying to find your identity and everything. And for me, luckily, it was like right around when rock and roll first started. So, you know, I had Elvis and Chuck Berry and all the classics, you know, and that's when I was 10, 11 years old. So I'm like, yeah, I'm in, you know, and that's when it started. And I think as time went on and my mother started getting married to the tune of 9 times total, I would like have difficult times during that growing up. And so I would turn to music and find comfort. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You obviously were hugely interested in the film medium. You started working on Saturday Night Live and did those shorts with Albert Brooks, which really started both of your careers, two extraordinary careers starting in this place. And I remember those Brooks shorts as being extraordinary. Like, what, you know, it was a little bit of a different flavor for that show at that time.
First today, we'll visit comedy take class. Here the students practice all kinds of takes. The double take, the elbow take, and today, they're working on the spit take.
All right, now that was pretty good, but I'd like to try it just one more time in the same way. Now remember, I've just walked into the room. Now start to drink. Good. Now I speak. Guess what? I just heard from the bank, and not only don't you have any money, but your sister is dead.
Did you always see yourself as a filmmaker who incorporated music, or did you want a music career at any point?
No, here's the thing. Back in the day, you know, being a woman, you didn't even dare say you were going to be a director, okay? Mm. So I was in film school in the late 60s, early 70s, and then right after that, I met Lorne, and he introduced me to Albert. He calls me up, and he goes, "Hey, Penelope, I found this guy, and he's really funny, and he doesn't know how to make movies, and you do, so will you show him?" And I said, I said, "Of course I will." So that's how I started producing those shorts for Albert. But I have to thank Albert because he really taught me a lot about Hollywood because I didn't know anything about it. And, you know, he taught me how to be neurotic. Like, if you're in a room for 4 years, that's what it was with Albert Brooks, you walk out nuts, okay? And then I worked with Richard Pryor, actually, before I even worked with Albert. I don't know how this happened to me in my life, but I ended up with a lot of amazing comedians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not easy people to work with, I imagine, because all perfectionists, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, I figured out, you know, that it's a cross between insanity and genius, you know? And I think it works really well together when people that are crazy geniuses are creative, you know? And I mean, that certainly applies, I think, to, and I mean that as a compliment, you know, I don't mean it as an insult, because I like crazy and I like genius, you know, and I like those kind of people. But yeah, I've been fortunate enough to work with Mike Myers and a lot of other people.
Yeah. Knowing that you came up with Elvis and Chuck Berry and 50s rock, there's a thing in certain people's lives where they stop listening at a certain point. And yet, if we just look at the three Decline of Western Civilization films, you know, punk comes along, you're not freaked out, you want to understand it. And you make one of the best films about punk rock ever. You know, hair metal is happening, the metal stuff is on in the late 80s, and you want to understand it. Same thing with gutter punk. You know, it seems like you're almost sociologically minded. You said before that in those difficult days of your mom's remarriages, you know, you found comfort in music. You want to understand the musical communities that come up, I've always thought.
Yeah, the culture and also just understand human behavior. You know, I think at the core of my filmmaking is just trying to understand why we humans behave the way we do, you know? For me, it's like, that's the most important part, and the music is a way to show it, you know? My interpretation of different generations, just cultures, you know?
Why did you cut your hair like that?
Because I'm searching.
He knows where it's at now.
And I'm looking for something.
And where it's at is to search. He's tried, so far he's tried, he's tried punk rock, he's tried
Jesus.
What are you searching for?
I really don't know. Now I'll know when I find it.
Was there a moment when you said, I've got to do this movie? I'm talking about your directorial debut, The Decline of Western Civilization, 1981. You know, punk rock wasn't exactly like a hot ticket. You know, I'm going to make millions doing this punk rock movie.
No.
And yet, you know, you're one of the primary documents of a very important part of L.A. music's evolution. And in that scene in particular, you got all the important bands, Black Flag and Circle Jerks and X and Fear, Germs, mm-hmm. in that movie. Was there a moment when you said, I've got to do this? I mean, do you remember how that sort of evolved into a movie?
You know, it was crazy because I was working with Albert, and Albert and all of his buddies, you know, it was James Brooks and Billy Crystal and Rob Reiner, and we were all hanging out together. And Albert was saying, oh, I'm such a great producer. And they said, why don't you go over and try and get this gig doing this Goldie Hawn movie at Warner Brothers called Private Benjamin. And I said, you know what? I'm not really down with this producing thing because it was really getting hard there working with Albert. So I said, I'm going to direct a punk rock movie and a documentary. And they laughed so hard at me. They, you know, they made fun of me, honestly, because they're comedians and they like to make fun of people. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was kind of hard to keep going. But I knew that I had this intense interest in not only the music, but this new kind of culture, because punk rock, I think, changed everything when it happened in the late 70s.
Were you immersed in the club scene? Did you go out and see bands quite a bit during that period of time? How did you come across? Because it was almost like you had to know where to go. I mean, these gigs weren't like well publicized. You would find a flyer on a lamppost, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
how
was it?
There was
no
social media.
Right. How were you sort of engaged with that scene?
Well, I was very much engaged with it before I thought to make the movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was actually sort of I took the nosedive into Hollywood working with Albert and Lorne, and then I've always kind of had, you know, that outcast one foot in the left side of the world because of being on the carnival, you know? And so when I saw the punks, I'm like, I kind of relate to these guys more than I do Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So I started, you know, I had a music video company back then called Rock and Reel. I think it was the only one around, really. You know, I was shooting music videos for the record company, so I had equipment all the time. And so I would shoot, you know, Seals and Crofts and Fleetwood Mac and Funkadelic and Doobie Brothers and stuff like that. And then at night I would go out and shoot punk rock.
That's great.
That sounds like good times. Funkadelic to the Germs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had, you know, I've been in a prison. No, I wasn't in prison, but I've been in a prison in Rahway Prison in New Jersey doing the Lifers Group, it was called. Mm. It was these rappers that were in there for life for murder. I mean, I've been all over the place shooting music, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's taken you literally around the world.
It totally has, yeah. Definitely has.
So, Penelope, if you had to choose, what sounds are closest to your heart? You know, what would you take to the desert island of, you know, would it be the metal stuff? Would it be the punk stuff? You know, would it be, I mean, you did an
Ozfest
documentary.
That's a really interesting question. That's an interesting question. Desert island, boombox. Let me concentrate here. I'm going to say Japanese Zen music. And I'm not kidding. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, here's the thing. Me and my boyfriend, who was a gutter punk on Decline 3 that I've known for 20 years, we went out on the Ozfest with Sharon and Ozzy. And I said to my boyfriend a couple years ago, I'm like, how come we don't go out to concerts anymore? And he goes, well, once you've been to 30 cities on the Ozfest, you don't even care anymore.
Yeah, I suppose you can overdose after a while.
Well, yeah. I mean, I still, you know, every once in a while I'll throw on some punk rock or some metal or some Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky or whatever, you know, but it's not like I've got to have my punk rock. I feel like at heart I am a punk, you know, that's just what I am, but I don't sit around, you know, listening to punk all day and spitting at people.
Reggae! I can do catch a thief! Reggae! Doody-doody! Reggae! I can be a perfect day! Reggae!
Well, as a documentarian, you said you wanted to learn about these cultures, about, you know, what made them tick. Why were people motivated to form, to create in this way, a clearly non-commercial way? What did you learn about the punks after you did the first Decline movie?
Well, you know, back then everybody was just trying to change things because you get it. Remember, it was disco all over the place. And music sucked, and look at the clothes. I mean, look at people's hair. You know what I mean? It's like they just wanted to flip it on its head, you know, and just change things, everything. And so music changed because of punk rock. I think attitudes toward women changed. I think politics changed. I think so many different things. It's certainly a different visual today. When you drive down the street and you see some kid on a skateboard, you know, he looks the way he does because of punk rock, you know?
Mm-hmm. And these bands were, you know, kind of out there on a limb. I think they lived very, they were not viewed as law-abiding citizens. They were viewed as a threat.
Oh, people were afraid of them.
Yeah,
then.
The audience was afraid. The police were, you know, out to get them. That was kind of the viewpoint in the culture.
The parents were about ready to just kill themselves. Mm, you know?
Right, right.
Because the visual of a punk rock back then was shocking. You know, mm-hmm. Punk rock person back then, it was just like it was sent fear through the straight people, and that's exactly what they wanted to do.
Why do you wear those clothes like that?
Uncomfortable.
At one time, maybe I was considered different, but now I'm in a comfortable lifestyle, and I can be myself.
Everyone's hair should be blue, because that's the best color. It looks so good.
You know, like when I first showed The Decline, the very first screening was at the Writers Guild, and the lady stood up after the film was over, and she said, "How dare you glorify these heathens?"
Tipper Gore was her name, actually.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, that was with the second film.
Yeah. And did you, as a woman, Penelope, did you ever have any trouble connecting, whether it's the hyper macho Kiss, you know, or any of the punk bands? I mean, they just seemed awkward around women. You know, the metal, many of those metal bands that you dealt with, not Saint Lemmy, but, you know, Aerosmith and Kiss. I mean,
it's funny you mentioned Lemmy, because I would say that in all, I love Lemmy, okay? In all of the musicians I've ever dealt with, he's the only one that tried to strangle me, literally.
Wow.
I know.
We're laughing, but that sounds serious.
That sounds like a compliment. He thought you were an equal.
I think that might be a compliment, yeah, but it was freaky because it was took me off, you know, by surprise. I was just finished shooting, and somebody actually took a picture of it, and that's why I'm for sure it happened, because he grabbed me from behind and started strangling with his elbow around my neck, and I'm like,
wow.
I don't know if this is love or hate, but it sure is freaky.
Yeah, but so you were dealing with so many sexually awkward young boys, you know, and that brings us back to Wayne's World too. How do you relate, you know, to these two doofuses, mm-hmm. you know, in their basement who talk about sex a lot, but you know they're not getting any.
Schwing.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Funny.
Yeah.
How do I relate? Well, I mean, I was the oldest of four children. My sister's a lesbian, and I have two brothers, so I just felt like one of the guys. You know, I think just coming up, I always had my head underneath the hood of a car. You know, mm-hmm. I can fix anything on a car, by the way, if anybody has a car breakdown. So, you know, I was just one of the dudes, you know, and I think that's probably why I do better with boy movies than girl movies. I mean, they sent me, you know, like, what was that Legally Blonde, okay? And I read it, and I'm like, I don't get this. Yeah. You know, I really can't relate. And they hounded me to direct it, and I'm sorry, I just don't understand. But I do better with dude movies. Yeah, I don't know why.
It's interesting, too, you know, talking about relating, because obviously you did the punk scene, but you had talked about in previous interviews, Penelope, about how Decline Part 2, about the metal scene in L.A. really helped create sort of a template for you for how to understand these two suburban dudes who were into this kind of metal-y music.
Mm-hmm. In Wayne's World.
In Wayne's World. What was that connection like? Did you feel like getting to know these L.A. scenesters on the Hollywood Strip trying to desperately get a record contract with the big hair, and they all looked alike in some ways, all behaved the same way. What was the connection between these two mythical guys who were in their Aurora basement?
Well, that is a very, very good question, and a very, astute to put those things together. But here's the thing, and I don't think I've ever told anybody this before. Wayne and Garth thought they were headbangers. I mean, like, their characters in the movie and kind of off camera as well. But having just stepped out of the real scene, I kind of had to like go along with it and go, yeah, sure, guys, you're headbangers. Yeah, sure.
But not really.
But I knew that they're not the real thing, but I was just sort of going along with it. And maybe that's part of what made the charm happen. I don't know.
Well, what you're getting at, I think, is a sort of naive innocence. They were fans, mm-hmm. and they were trying mm-hmm. to act like these heroes that they saw on the TV screen, but they really couldn't be those guys ever, and that was the joy of it. Right?
Neither Wayne nor Garth would ever be Gene Simmons.
No, and I think you hit on something there, because people always ask, you know, what is it about Wayne's World? And I think it is that innocence. It's that joie de vivre, if you want to say it, where, you know, you're at a certain age and you think the whole world is butterflies and flowers, and it's, you know, you're going to just go out there and live the most wonderful life ever, and then you start to learn about reality. But before that, before that, you're like Wayne and Garth, and really, really optimistic, and I think it's their optimism that is their charm.
Okay, I still live with my parents, which I admit is both bogus and sad. But at least I've got an amazing cable access show, and I still know how to party. But what I'd really love is to do Wayne's World for a living. It might happen. Yeah, and monkeys might fly out of my butt.
Yeah, and the fandom. You know, they live for this
music.
And
they're fans. Yeah. And you know, when we took it, like when I took out Decline on the road recently and to the theatrical art house circuit, people would come up to me and honestly, that sometimes they would be crying. They would put their arms around me and say, thank you for helping me. Thank you for doing the movie and helping me figure out who I was when I couldn't do it.
Yeah. Because it was harder when those movies came out, to connect with these worlds. If you weren't living somewhere hip like New York or Los Angeles, you're living in Montana, this is going to open your eyes.
Well, on that box set we did, and I'm not trying to sell them, believe me, but Dave Grohl does the voiceover for Decline 1, and he said that's what happened to him, is his cousin, he went and visited his cousin in a different state, and she was like, hey, man, come here, I got to show you this thing. It was like contraband, you know? And it had a video cassette of the first Decline. It was like, check this out, and it's like really opened his eyes, and that's why he's got Pat Smear in his band, you know?
Right. He has told that story. Actually, she lived in Chicago.
He
came here.
See, it's the truth.
Yeah. Coming up, we'll finish our chat with Penelope Spheeris and dive deep into the making of Wayne's World and that iconic headbanging scene to Bohemian Rhapsody. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
I think we'll go with a little Bohemian Rhapsody, gentlemen.
Good call.
I see a little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango? Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo.
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 Galileo. Galileo Figaro.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot, and he's Jim DeRogatis. And that is part of the Bohemian Rhapsody scene for the 1992 film Wayne's World. I mean, you hear the song, you know right away. You think of that scene, right? It's like so associated with that moment.
Well, we have been Wayne and Garth. You know that, right? I mean, it was a little bit of Bill and Ted, but mostly Wayne and Garth.
Yeah, and the roles switch, from moment to moment. Sometimes he's Garth, sometimes he's Wayne, you know. And that scene, as well as countless others, directed by our guest today, Penelope Spheeris, 30 years later,
the movie is still extremely beloved, as you can tell, because of that goofy humor in Garth Spacer.
And the love of
the
music.
The Mirthmobile.
The love of music. Yeah,
absolutely. Singing Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, as I said, completely associated with that movie. We had read that the scene almost didn't happen, so we had asked Penelope whether that was true.
No, not at all.
Good.
No.
I love to debunk these stories. Because the story goes that you wanted Guns N' Roses and Myers pushed for Queen.
That's hilarious. You know why that's hilarious? Because it is so opposite of true. Here's the thing. Guns N' Roses were supposed to be in decline too, and they were going to close the movie. And their manager pulled out at the last second. Slash was down with it. Axl was down with it. It was all going to happen, and they pulled out. And therefore, I got Megadeth, okay? So I do Wayne's World as my next movie. Now, do you think that I'm going to go and ask Guns N' Roses to be in my effing movie? I don't think so.
Yeah. The hell with
and, screw those dudes. And actually, lately, I saw Slash, and he apologized that they, didn't do it. But, life is what it is. But no, if somebody made that story up, sounds like Mike or something. But I never wanted Guns N' Roses in the movie. He wanted Aerosmith.
And he wanted Aerosmith.
Well, for the performance piece, right. That Alice did. And they appeared in the second one.
Mm-hmm.
That I did not appear in.
A vastly inferior sequel.
Yeah, nobody remembers that movie, Penelope.
Nobody. There should not have been a Wayne's World 2, no.
Well, not so quick anyway,
Yeah. All right, so was it your idea for Bohemian Rhapsody from the beginning?
No, it wasn't my idea. And see, that's the thing about punk rockers. See, I told you I'm a punk rocker at heart. We tell the truth, okay? I ain't flowering nothing up here. It was not my idea. It was Mike's idea, and it was written into the script when I got the script, and I shot it. I will say this. He wasn't real happy when I made him bang his head for 6 hours.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he did,
I have read that.
And he did maintain that it wasn't funny, but the fact is he was being a good actor, and he followed the direction, and he did it, and it's the scene everybody remembers.
Yeah, it wouldn't work without the head banging. That's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that was critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Well, though, the song is too long. You got to do something. It's like nine minutes long.
Yeah. Did you relate to the song? Because, the one thing that I think was extraordinary about that is it basically gave Queen a second life. I mean, Freddie Mercury was dying. The band was effectively a non-entity for a number of years on the charts. And that sent him, that started a whole new round of Queen appreciation and sales.
Oh, I mean, it sold records.
That's not the kind of song that you'd put in there and saying, oh, people are going to instantly relate to this because that song really hadn't been part of the culture for a number of years. I mean, it was a 70s hit. So how did you think that was going to work in that scene? This is a critical scene.
Well,
you're setting the stage for this movie.
To answer your first question, yes, I always loved Queen, and I didn't even question that it would work in the film. I didn't think it would work as well as it did, that's for darn sure.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing about the movie and the music. It all came together in some sort of magical way where the planets were lined up right, the chemistry of the right people were together, everybody was at the peak of their game. There's very seldom in life did things line up like that. Wayne's World was a magical moment. And this guy says to me, he goes, don't you think that just because you had that big hit with Wayne's World that every movie you do now is going to be a big hit like that? And I thought, you watch me, brother. But here's the thing. He was right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of thing. It only happens once in a lifetime, I think. And, I certainly don't take credit for the whole movie or for any of it, really. I mean, I was in the right place at the right time.
My name is Wayne Campbell. I live in Aurora, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Excellent.
Other rumors about the movie, okay? A lot of people we talk to still think that movie was shot in Aurora, Illinois, the suburb.
I feel so bad for them.
They embrace it because it's they're wearing the Blackhawks jerseys when they're playing street hockey. So they think this is a Chicago movie. Now, Myers has said, apparently, his suburban upbringing in Canada evoked this kind of a scene to him. Do you have a sense of why Aurora was the spot where mythically he was going to be doing this show from?
I remember them saying, we have to just get something that is so typically suburban, and what could it be? And there was a bunch of talk about it, you know. And actually, the funniest thing was the writers and Mike were so concerned about the look of the house that Mike lived in. And I must have looked at 50 houses in the valley, you know, out here, not in Aurora. And they all look alike. Okay, exactly, alike. And I just picked one. What the hell? I'll just take this one. And so everybody, like, tries to find that house now. I think it's cool. It's actually a really, really big compliment that people care that much about the movie. And I know that there's, like, a website that shows where all the locations really were. And I'm proud that people think it was shot in Aurora, because that means, you know, we did a good job as filmmakers.
There are a lot of memorable cameos in Wayne's World. Chris Farley, Alice Cooper, Ed O'Neill. But I want to take a minute to talk about Meatloaf. He makes an appearance in the film as a bouncer outside a club. How did you come up, Penelope, with the idea of putting Meatloaf in your movie?
You know, I was actually at a party before Meatloaf became really, really famous, and he was there, and he was wearing this big trench coat, and there was a whole bunch of, like, buffet-type food on the table. And I watched him pick up pork chops and put
in his pockets.
Pocket.
Yeah.
We were trying to find little cameos, you know, and it could have well been my idea to have Meatloaf in there. I'm not going to take credit for it because I'm not 1,000% sure. But we just wanted little cameos all along the place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Meatloaf.
How about Alice Cooper? We're Not Worthy and that whole thing. It's just so brilliant.
Well, you know, I had just worked with Alice doing a music video for my old buddy, God bless him, Wes Craven, for that Shocker video. And I worked with Alice, and I worked with Dave Mustaine there. And I had worked with Alice and wanted to have him in the film because Aerosmith didn't want to do the movie because I think they didn't think it was very cool.
Whereas Alice has a great sense of humor.
Well, that's the thing is, man, we slammed him with, like, you know, 2 pages of dialogue. He thought he was just going to sit there and look freaky and then sing a song, which he's really good at doing both, but then he had to do the dialogue. But, you know, he stepped it up.
Alice, is this cool?
Yeah, come on in.
Sorry to bother you, but we had to come and tell you how much we really enjoyed the show, didn't we, Garth?
Oh, thanks.
We're not mental or anything, so don't be afraid.
We're not worthy! We're not worthy!
But lately, I talked to Alice, and he told me after all these years, he was a little bit upset about something in the movie. And I said, my goodness, we never want to upset Alice. What was it? He goes, that you put a snake on Cassandra. And I'm like, oh man, we totally blew it. You're right. It was a total subconscious decision. We weren't trying to rip you off, man.
I wanted to riff on that because you're dropping these names like Alice and Meatloaf, and you mentioned Axel and Slash like they were personal friends of yours. And how did you relate to all these characters? I mean, they're not let you into their world that easily, you know. And yet you seem to have developed a relationship with all of them.
Yeah, because I'm not the hottest taco on the fiesta platter, okay? So they don't really look at me like they're going to get laid later. Mm-hmm. And that's really back in those days, that's what it was all about, okay? So, you know, they just kind of, I just dress in a black leather jacket and black, I don't do it up, you know? And so they just kind of treat me like one of the guys. And that's fine with me because I can get my work done that way.
Well, it certainly holds up. I mean, you know, it's one of those movies where I think it was kind of thought of as maybe a goof, you know, at the start. And now it's become this iconic film for multiple generations of people, you know.
I know.
You know, to the point where people are dressing up like the characters in a way that's sort of timeless, you know.
But it really sounds like you were saying, Penelope, that Decline 1 is the one that you'd rather you'd have first on your tombstone.
Oh yeah, for sure, definitely. Yeah.
We're with you.
Actually, no, I'm gonna back that up. Decline 3, because for me, Decline 3 is I don't know, the most important movie I've made just because of the social statement with regard to homeless kids out on the street.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And so also that's where I met the love of my life, Sin, S-I-N. And he's from Florida, and he was a train riding gutter punk. And let me tell you something, I sure did learn a lot about just survivalism. I'm a survivalist after being with him for 20 years. I need no luxury and want no luxury.
I got you. Well, yeah, that's where you started, and then you wind up back there.
Yeah, I'm comfortable being poor, even though I have like a load of money. I'm really comfortable being poor. Can I swear? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, it's public radio.
It's fine.
Oh, yeah.
It has been a complete honor and privilege talking to Penelope Spheris. Thank you so much, Penelope.
Oh, thank you, guys. And Chicago, do rock on. Excellent. Okay, guys, party on.
That wraps up our chat with Penelope Spheris, one of our favorite guests ever. And now we want to hear from you. If you want to let us know your opinions, leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, fresh back from vacation, what do we have on the show next week?
Yes, Jim. Next week, it's time to unwrap some more buried treasures. A bunch of songs that are flying underneath the radar that we think you need to hear. And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed.
Absolutely. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.